provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenes, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about venture capital in CW 43 and 44. Frenes specializes in B2B market research for venture capital teams, providing landscape screenings and startup segmentations with a strong focus on the tech space.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our focus today is really synthesizing the most crucial insights and top venture capital trends we saw circulating on LinkedIn during calendar weeks 43 and 44.
Yeah, and we're aiming this squarely at professionals like you across M&A, private equity, VC, and consulting. The mission is simple. Cut through the noise, deliver the key signals.
We want to unpack what's driving this, well, massive urgency in capital deployment right now.
Exactly. And why AI is still, you know, the dominant theme, plus how LPs and founders are navigating this, frankly, pretty pressurized environment.
Okay, so let's dive into that core conflict first, the tension around the capital clock and LP dynamics. The starting point is just the sheer scale of dry powder.
Right.
VCs are sitting on a staggering $580 billion that needs to find a home.
That number is just huge. And it's not sitting comfortably, is it? No. Kevin Jiang pointed out something crucial. Mm-hmm. Those funds raised back in, say, 2019 to 2021, they're now hitting that critical 5 to 7 year window. He calls it the deploy or die territory.
Yeah, bluntly put, but accurate. If you can't get that capital committed, you risk having to return it.
Which is death for raising your next fund, basically.
Absolutely. And that pressure cooker environment directly informs the rigor we're seeing from LPs now. Tuma Selanyi put it really well.
How so?
He said, LPs aren't giving capital to VCs for safety. They're not looking for stability here. They demand asymmetric, really outsized returns.
Okay.
So if a fund is underwriting an early stage deal, the minimum expectation, the floor, is now a 3x net return.
Wait, 3x net, minimum. That's significant. How does that actually change the investment strategy on the ground? Doesn't that force VCs to chase only the absolute moonshots?
It absolutely does. It just reinforces that VC is fundamentally about hitting home runs, not, you know, singles or doubles.
Right.
If your fund isn't structured to capture those massive outliers, you're just not going to meet that LP mandate. It means maybe passing on deals that look merely safe or incrementally profitable.
Okay. And speaking of rigor, there was that crucial point from Arshad Chowdhury about safeguards. It reflects this kind of high stakes, maybe slightly wary environment.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
LPs are demanding direct, unfiltered conversations with the general partners, really validating the strategy, but also screening for any potential fraud signals.
Yeah, exactly. And even the smallest detail can apparently trigger deep skepticism now. Chowdhury mentioned LPs getting highly suspicious about any changes to recipient bank account details for wire transfers.
Ah, interesting. Like, even if there's a legitimate reason.
Apparently so. The due diligence is just tightening up everywhere, making sure the money flows exactly where the GP says it will.
Okay. But despite all that rigor, capital is flowing.
Yeah.
Particularly in certain places, right?
Yeah.
Europe seemed to lead in October.
That's right. Europe saw about $10 billion raised in October. And interestingly, the lion's share of that went into the very earliest stages, pre-seed and seed.
Okay. So still appetite for early risk.
Definitely. And we saw some major fund closes that confirm that institutional confidence is still there for, you know, specific proven teams. Sequoia closed an early stage vehicle at $750 million.
Wow.
Box Group raised $550 million across two funds. And Lifeline Ventures, the Finnish firm, they secured $400 million. So the money's concentrated, it's selective, but it's definitely ready to move for the right managers.
Right. Okay, let's shift gears a bit then, moving from the flow of capital to the structure of the VC firms themselves. This is especially relevant for aspiring managers launching their first funds. Myrtle Lalico's outlined some critical pieces often overlooked.
Yeah, she really emphasized things beyond just sourcing deals and doing diligence. Like, you absolutely must define your LP base clearly and ensure total strategic alignment. So if you're building, say, a specialized fintech fund, every angel deal you've done, every blog post you write, your entire pipeline has to scream fintech.
So LPs look at you and think, okay, they are the obvious choice for this niche.
Precisely. It's about focus.
And that structural part, setting up the fund, that's actually getting cheaper, which I found fascinating. Lalico's noted the cost has dropped dramatically.
Yeah, from maybe $50,000 to $150,000 previously, down to only about $5,000 today to get the basic infrastructure up.
Which sounds great, but...
But it's a double-edged sword, right? Easier entry means way more competition for that limited LP capital. And that makes the next hurdle she mentioned, attribution, even more critical.
Attribution rights. This seems to blindside so many new GPs coming out of established firms. Can you unpack why that's such a big deal?
It's basically a legal and, well, financial roadblock. You can't legally claim your track record or reference those successful deals from your previous firm when you're talking to LPs.
Well, you can't even mention them.
Not unless you specifically negotiated attribution rights when you joined that firm, or, more likely, when you left. That track record, it belongs to the firm, not the individual VC, legally speaking.
Wow.
So without those rights, you're essentially starting from zero in terms of provable institutional history. You have to rely solely on maybe your proprietary deal flow, your angel investments, your network.
That really highlights the power dynamic within those big firms. Okay, so this kind of sets the stage for that persistent debate, spray and pray versus conviction investing. Ruben Dominguez Ibar and Peter Walker actually brought data to this.
Right, using simulations, comparing a high volume diversified approach, lots of small checks, versus a concentrated one, fewer bigger bets.
And what did the simulations show?
Well, the data suggested diversification generally wins out. The portfolio with, say, 100 startups getting $400,000 each consistently outperformed the one with 20 startups getting $2 million each.
In terms of returns.
Yeah, higher average and median fund multiples. The diversified approach showed a 2.6x mean multiple versus 2.1x for the concentrated one in their simulation.
And crucially, what about downside protection, capital preservation?
Significantly better with diversification. The simulated diversified fund had like a 99.7% chance of returning at least 1x capital. So the data points towards diversification being the safer, more reliable path for most funds.
Okay, so the numbers lean towards spreading bets.
They do. As they put it, venture isn't a picking game, it's a portfolio game. Concentration, according to the data, only really pays off if you happen to be in that elite top 5% of all funds.
Which raises that fascinating question about VC ego, doesn't it? Dan G called it the illusion of skill. If the math favors diversification for 95% of funds, why do so many VCs still push the narrative of concentrated, high-conviction bets?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Is it truly about optimizing LP returns, or is it more about building a personal narrative of being the genius outlier picker?
Yeah. Seems like a potential misalignment. It's almost like self-sabotage for the average GP if they follow that concentrated path without being truly exceptional.
And Corey Epstein offered a maybe more philosophical take on why so many funds fail. He suggested it's because many VCs lack deep, genuine industry expertise.
So they invest in what they know or think they know.
Exactly. They gravitate towards founders who kind of mirror their own blind spots, confirming their existing level of understanding. And that leads them to pass on the truly complex, maybe contrarian ideas they just don't get.
Okay, interesting. Let's pivot then to the founders themselves. Theme three, guidance and pitching discipline. The big shift seems to be resilience over just pure polish. Rim and Kim emphasize founder market fit being paramount now.
Absolutely. VCs are scrutinizing the jockey much more than just the horse. They're looking for those intrinsic qualities, grit, genuine resilience, a unique, maybe non-consensus insight into the market, deeply held beliefs, and critically, a real unfair advantage. Why are you and your team uniquely capable of weathering the storm and winning?
And that resilience, that insight, it has to stand up under some pretty intense scrutiny during the pitch, right? Haram Chaudhary shared a fascinating story about using an AI investor simulation tool.
Yeah, that was interesting. Tell me more.
So this founder used a tool that basically simulated different investor types, angel, VC, corporate, and adapted its questions accordingly.
Wow. Okay. And what happened?
It provided immediate, almost brutal clarity. The simulated angel investor zeroed in on some questionable market research, the VC simulation. It drilled right into the unit economics and instantly flagged that the cash to LTV ratio was, well, broken. They'd lose money as they scaled.
Ouch. The classic scaling problem.
And the corporate investor sim asked the most practical thing. How does this shiny new thing actually integrate with existing messy enterprise workflows?
The killer question for B2B.
Exactly. And the founder apparently didn't have a good answer. The tool generated like 12 pages of red flags.
Yeah.
It just shows how specialized and deep the diligence is getting.
And that ties perfectly into the three key red flags that Richard Stroop highlighted, citing Juan Carlos Pacheco. The immediate fundraise killers.
Which are?
One, arrogance.
Yeah.
Kills the partnership potential instantly. Two, weak command of the numbers. Signals operational chaos. Three, saying you have no competition.
Okay, arrogance, weak numbers, those make sense.
Okay.
Arrogance poisons the... Well, weak numbers mean you don't know your business. But why is saying no competition such a huge red flag? Isn't that good?
It's actually a sign of market naivety. If a founder genuinely thinks there's zero competition, it usually means one of two things.
Okay.
Either they haven't researched the market deeply enough, or they're defining their market way too narrowly. Often, competition is actually proof that a market exists and that customers are willing to pay. It's validation, not just a threat.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. So switching slightly, let's talk access, getting in the door. Patrick Casey shared some hard numbers confirming what we probably all suspect.
Warm intros still rule.
Massively. Response rates jumped to 60% plus with a warm introduction, compared to maybe 1% to 5% for cold emails. The network is still absolutely dominating the top of the funnel.
But that reliance on warm intros, it inherently brings up the flip side. The pedigree bias that Shrameha called out.
Right, he shared that anecdote.
Yeah, the viral story about the founder who got ignored, then created a fake profile, IIT and Stanford credentials, and boom, suddenly, top VCs who'd ignored his actual idea were falling over themselves to talk to the fake profile.
Oof, that story is depressing, but really instructive about initial screening.
It absolutely signals that bias is still deeply embedded, right? Whether it's automated filters or just human pattern matching. While VCs should counter this, respond to every credible outreach regardless of source, the reality is that bias toward perceived elite backgrounds still exists, especially at that first gate.
Okay, let's move to our final theme then, market focus and the enduring AI thesis. No surprises here, AI is still running the show, largely. Evelina Deneva and Agatha Theory confirmed its dominance in Europe.
Yeah, over 35% of recent European funding rounds were AI-related, and Sun Choi really captured the prevailing Silicon Valley view on why.
Yep.
He called AI a multi-leverage structure. Stressed that the real moats aren't just clever algorithms anymore. It's about massive infrastructure, huge data scale, and frankly, deep pockets. That dynamic makes it incredibly tough for smaller players to build truly defensible AI platforms.
That makes sense for pure play AI, but we're also seeing a really interesting strategic rotation of capital, which feels even more significant, maybe. Russell Sean Languedoc highlighted that huge Apollo 8 VC partnership.
Ah, yeah, deploying billions into industrial infrastructure, real assets, buildings, logistics.
Exactly. And the argument there, as Languedoc put it, is that AI becomes the competitive moat in these non-tech businesses.
Right. Not by being the product itself, but by optimizing legacy processes. Like procurement, find 30% plus savings there through AI. That's massive, immediate EBIT gain in previously unsexy industry.
And that's where the real leverage shifts, potentially. Okay, but let's temper all this enthusiasm with the harsh reality of founder outcomes. Valuations have been high, right? Chris Topman shared Carta data.
Yeah, high benchmarks. Seed median around $19 million, Series A 75th percentile nudging $100 million on paper, especially for anything AI related.
But paper value isn't cash in the bank for founders.
Exactly. And that's where the grim financial math kicks in. Rui dos Santos shared that sobering anecdote.
The $1 billion exit.
That one. Founder sells the company for $1 billion, a huge success by any measure, yet the founder personally walked away with less than $10 million.
Less than 1% of the sale price. How does that even happen?
Layers and layers of dilution from multiple funding rounds, coupled with powerful liquidation preferences held by later stage investors.
Ah, the preferences.
If VCs have, say, 2x or 3x liquidation preferences, they get 2 or 3 times their investment back before the founder, and often all the common shareholders see a single penny. In anything other than a truly spectacular exit, those preferences can just wipe out the founder's equity entirely.
So a high valuation today can mean a high risk of zero payout tomorrow if things don't go perfectly.
Precisely. It's a crucial lesson in cap table management and understanding deal terms.
Okay, one last quick tactical tip for founders from Harry Stebbings. He advised seed stage founders.
What was it?
Avoid bringing co-founders to those very first VC pitch calls. Keep that initial meeting strictly 1.1. Focus on building that personal relationship first.
Interesting. Makes sense. Keep it focused early on. All right. So maybe a final provocative thought for you, our listeners, to chew on.
Lay it on us.
Given the statistical data we discussed, showing diversification generally outperforms concentration for, you know, the vast majority of funds, is the prevailing VC ego that illusion of skill Dan G mentioned, is it truly optimized for maximizing LP returns and overall fund success? Or does it maybe prioritize creating a personal narrative, the story of being that elite outlier spotting genius? Something to think about.
If you enjoyed this deep dive, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on private equity, M&A, and strategy and consulting. Thank you for joining us as we unpack the VC landscape of calendar weeks 43 and 44. Hit that subscribe button so you don't miss our next analysis.